disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This is America, February 6, 2021. On today's episode, we launch into resistance news, from updates on the fight against the Line 3 pipeline in the Midwest, to continuing rent strikes in major cities, and ongoing fierce abolitionist struggle from Portland to New York. We then switch to our discussion, where we offer an analysis of Trumpism and CPAC 2021, along with a critique of the elite's existing obsession with the culture war. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. Resistance to the Line 3 pipeline continues, both in so-called Minnesota and across the United States.
What is Line 3? A lot of people want to know, and a lot of people don't know. So think of it this way. There are six really old pipelines that they put through in northern Minnesota, shipping diluted tar sands from Alberta to Superior, Wisconsin. And one of those lines is called Line 3. It has, according to Enbridge, about 900 structural anomalies in it. Structural anomalies are things like small little pinhole leaks, maybe it comes some cracks, and some of those end up to be big problems, like that Kalamazoo spill. That was a structural anomaly. Line 3, it's old and it's corroding and it's at the end of its life. It's already had a number of leaks and spills, and frankly, it's a catastrophe waiting to happen.
A week of action is also being planned from March 8th to the 15th. Check out the GNU Collective for more information. Here's a roundup of some recent actions. In New York City on March 3rd, there was a street blockade in solidarity with the struggle against Line 3. On the same day in Grand Rapids, Michigan, people also rallied against the pipeline and to commemorate the 30th anniversary of a massive Enbridge oil spill of 1.7 million gallons. On March 1st, protesters at the University of Minnesota rallied outside of a Chase Bank to demand divestment from the Line 3 pipeline project. On February 24th, Unicorn Riot reports that two different blockades took place, including people locking themselves inside a flipped-over car. On February 17th, a banner was dropped in solidarity with water protectors fighting the Line 3 pipeline by the Cascadia Forest Defenders. On February 16th, Unicorn Riot reports that 30 water protectors and Line 3 resistors walked onto a worksite halting construction of a section of the pipeline in indigenous territory. On February 12th, people protested outside of Wells Fargo Bank in San Francisco to demand divestment from the Line 3 pipeline. On February 6th, an anonymous communique posted to Puget Sound anarchists claimed responsibility for busting out windows belonging to banks funding the Line 3 pipeline. The communique reads, "In the early hours of Saturday, February 6th, on occupied Chinook land known as Portland, Chase banks throughout the city were attacked in solidarity with the fight against the Line 3 pipeline expansion, a project being funded by Chase Bank. Line 3 would further the poisoning of the land, water, and atmosphere and violates the sovereignty of the Anishinaabe people. We say no to genocide and ecocidal colonial capitalist projects. No pipelines, no walls. Land back. Fuck 12. On February 5th, water protectors marched into the Enbridge construction site and shut it down. Unicorn Riot reports that on February 4th, water protectors also engaged in a lockdown and blockade that shut down construction at an Enbridge fueling station and Line 3 pipeline construction worksite as supporters rallied. In housing resistance news, people continue to occupy People's Park in so-called Berkeley, California. People's Park, located outside of the UC Berkeley campus, was the site of ongoing riots and land occupations from the late 1960s onwards. Since it was first occupied, the park has been utilized as a hub for communal life, gardening, free food, and political organizing. In the last few weeks, the university has attempted to set up fences and begin construction of housing units, only to have groups of people break the fences apart and remove them from the park. Since then, an occupation of the park has remained ongoing. Tacoma Housing Now! Organized a blockade of an intersection in response to five people dying on the streets due to exposure to winter conditions.
Now, are we agreeing no paying of rent until Yeah.
Right.
Until we see that water and until they send it prorated.
That's right.
No water, no rest. Even if they turn on the water tomorrow, don't pay rent until we meet on the
town. Right.
Right. I'll resolve it. I say, go and take.
Right.
Tenants in a southwest Houston apartment complex are on rent strike following the wave of storms which have left many without water and busted pipes. Tenants are demanding that their water be turned back on and that their pipes be fixed and are refusing to pay rent until they do. Follow the Houston Tenant Union for updates on social media. Speaking of rent strikes that kicked off during the pandemic continue full steam ahead in cities like DC and LA. Meanwhile, up north in Six Nations territory, the 1492 Land Back Lane reclamation continues. The barricades starting in mid-February on the roads started to come down. See the latest video dispatch from Submedia TV and 1492 Land Back Lane on Facebook for more information. Speaking of indigenous resistance, fighting against pipelines in so-called Vancouver continues. People blockaded the Port of Vancouver for over a day in solidarity with Indigenous man Stacy Gallinger, who was sentenced to 90 days in jail for protesting the Trans Mountain Pipeline sites in Burnaby. Also, Indigenous youth occupied an insurance office to demand divestment from the Trans Mountain Valley Pipeline. In abolitionist news, in Modesto, California, groups continue to demonstrate against recent police murders and acts of police brutality in working-class communities. In late February, over 100 people in so-called Portland gathered for a militant march and rally against ICE. Daniel V. Media reports that anti-ICE graffiti slogans were written across the downtown and on government buildings. On February 12th, people took to the streets of New York against police brutality, burning Blue Lives Matter flags outside of the NYPD's Times Square station. In Tigard, Oregon, anarchists conducted an outreach campaign, handing out flyers and posting them up with mental health resources and alternatives to calling the police after law enforcement shot someone having a mental health crisis. Police responded to the outreach campaign by closely following the group through residential neighborhoods. On February 5th, the American Indian Movement, or AIM, led over 100 people in a protest against ICE in downtown Portland. Also on February 5th in Brooklyn, people marched against the police officer who pulled a gun out on protesters several weeks ago and in memory of Trayvon Martin. Mine workers have issued a statement in solidarity with an indigenous blockade of their mining operation. An open letter written by a sizable minority of mine employees currently stranded by the protests says they recognize the Inuit as the rightful custodians of the land. About 700 staff from southern provinces have been stranded at the mine site since a group of protesters staged a blockade last week, blocking roads and the airstrip. The protesters object to a proposed expansion of the mine and fear the impacts it would have on the water and surrounding areas. The miners write in a statement, "We are writing to express our full support of the efforts, means, and goals of your protest. We do not pretend to represent the views of the majority of the workers, but we do represent a sizable minority. We recognize the Inuit as the rightful custodians of the land and the people who should make the decisions about how it is used. Your protest has generated a lot of conversation among the workers here. Many of us are disappointed that our flights to return home or postponed, but some also consider it a small thing compared to the hundreds of years of colonization and cultural erasure that Indigenous people have experienced and continue to experience at the hands of the Canadian government and the private sector." Meanwhile, workers at Voodoo Donut in downtown Portland are fighting to be recognized under the banner of the Industrial Workers of the World. Finally, in Detroit, an autonomous group of self-organized workers were able to mobilize and distribute thousands of masks to service workers in the Detroit area. And now for some upcoming events. On Saturday, March 6th in Denton, Texas, there is an open mutual aid free store being organized by several autonomous groups. On March 6th through the 7th, the Youth Liberation Front is calling for a day of action, and in cities across the so-called United States, there are everything from marches to workshops being planned. Check our show notes for more information. On March 8th through the 14th, there is a week of action called against the Line 3 pipeline. On Saturday, March 20th, in Brooklyn, New York, there is an anti-racist and anti-fascist block party being called. On Sunday, March 28th, at the Salem Capitol, there is a call for an anti-fascist mobilization against the far right. From August 21st through September 9th, there is a call for abolitionist actions in solidarity with prison struggles on the inside. And finally, if you value what's going down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. And sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation through the site or on Bitcoin. You can also tell a friend about It's Going Down, listen to us on the radio, and follow us on social media platforms. Thanks so much for listening, and let's get into it.
Left, right, left. How long can we holler when it ain't no breath? You keep killing fathers without no regrets. Then keep on counting dollars till it ain't none left. So the streets gon' keep on marching like left, right, left. Fuck your empty promises, these ain't no threats. Streets is taking all of it, you made your bed. Fix it, always problems, we ain't going nowhere. Bring it straight up to your door, now who running, ho? A knee and a neck is this week's symbol of shit you've been reaping. As a reaper of people, there's no equal to the police, and they be their own sequel. So consistently as a monster, paid by a system set up to prosper on victims of the historic situating as property. People that are melanated, so easily separated, know what? Fuck the history lesson, you know by now. We do not know how to keep playing dumb but still be trusted. With guns you must be defunded. This march is not a one-off. This march is not the missing warning shot. This march I put in your fucking throat to choke out the whole assumption that you are here to protect us. This government doesn't respect us, and somehow they seem to expect us to accept the power of piece of shit playing the president wants to project. Fuck are you getting at? Get the fuck back in the bunker. We taking back spaces till you manage to make them safer black faces. That's up to the fact that America's racist. Donald Trump is a white.
Okay, we are back again for another week. Lots to talk about as always. We're going to start off by talking about CPAC and everything around it. CPAC is the annual Conservative Political Action Conference. It kind of brings together sort of the really amped up, like nerdy rank and file people that wear like kind of like corn cob, like weird hats that only like weird conservatives wear, and like dumb buttons. People that like, you know, think that Roger Stone is the shit, basically.
Yeah.
And like go to these like really strange conferences. So those type of people, and also of course, you know, the who's who of sort of like the Republican elites. Although it was interesting that like people such as Liz Cheney were not there. It was this was definitely like the Trumpian sort of sect on parade. We're gonna be unpacking that. Also, Paul Gosar appeared along with Steve King at the America First Political Action Conference, which is headed by the white nationalist and Charlottesville marcher Nick Fuentes. We're going to be talking about that. And also, too, just looking at this kind of obsession with the culture war that's really emanated. It was really on display at CPAC. And there's a lot of other things we're going to talk about as we go forward. But just kind of start off with CPAC. I thought one of the first things that really caught my eye was just the fact that they had this golden Trump statue that they brought out. And there's no way. I mean, if you're not familiar with the Christian Bible, there's a story in it where God gets really mad at this pagan group of people that have a golden calf, and he's like, yes. Why are you worshiping this golden calf? And like there's a whole thing about how God says, you know, supposedly that, you know, you should put no other idols before me, like I'm right. The only one. He's very 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 angry, like I need all your attention.
Yeah, it is one of the commandments. I mean, as a yeah. you know, really bad Catholic high school student, I forget which one, but it's definitely one of the commandments.
But literally,
so it's like really serious for Christians to, you know, not worship false idols, specifically ones made out of gold.
And there's no way they didn't know that. And it was almost like a kind of, I think part of it had to have been like a middle finger to Pence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here is our golden idol, and it's Trump. And like people were like taking photos with it, kissing it. It really seemed like a middle finger to Pence, which is funny because without that rather large voting block of evangelicals,
yes.
I mean, there goes another section of the Trumpian coalition. And what's interesting about CPAC is they did a straw poll and it said only 55% supported Trump being president in 2024, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, so they do these straw polls at CPAC every year, right? And they're presidential straw polls, even in years like this, which we just had an election. And these straw polls are really interesting because they're not generally reflective of the conservative movement as a whole. They're reflective of a very specific subset of kind of far right-wing Republican, very specifically. And CPAC itself has changed a lot over the years. I mean, it used to be like a largely kind of like Grover Norquist style, like small government economic libertarian kind of gathering. It has become a lot more sort of authoritarian and Christian over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But yeah, so these straw polls reflect this. What's interesting, though, is that the straw polls are often way farther to the right than the actual Republican voter base. So I forget which year it was, but like Rick Santorum won a straw poll one year, right? Rick Santorum has never gotten even close to being a presidential nominee for a major political party, like not even close. He won a straw poll at CPAC one year, right? So what's fascinating about that 55% number is that that number actually trends high compared to the rest of the conservative movement. So if we can assume that 55% of people at CPAC want to see Trump run again, that number is actually probably closer to 35 or 40% when you're talking about the conservative movement as a whole, which involves a lot of different factions, including evangelical Christians who, though they voted for Donald Trump, weren't particularly fond of him as a human. Right. And that they did that because of Mike Pence, largely, as you mentioned. So, you know, CPAC this year very specifically was very Trumpy. Right. And it has been for a little bit. I mean, that's not new. Right. It's been that way ever since about 2015. Donald Trump has loomed very large, even though he refused to go to CPAC in 2016 to give a speech because they like banned white nationalists or something, and he felt that they were like violating free speech or something, so he didn't go. But the conference was nonetheless very Trumpy, and it has continued to be so. What is interesting about it is Trump is no longer in office. And so we've been talking for weeks on this show about political realignments, right? And this kind of formation of a Trumpian wing of the Republican Party. Which involves a number of other realignments, right? Like the Proud Boys are kind of falling apart. A number of white nationalist groups are falling apart. It was March 4th today and QAnon didn't do anything, right? Even though this was supposedly the day that the storm was going to happen again. The right wing is in disarray. And so watching CPAC became really relevant to the degree that we can see where a faction of the Republican Party is going. Now, we're going to talk about AFPAC in a little bit, America First Political Action Conference, which Nick Fuentes hosted. That's going to tell us a little bit about a slightly different wing of the conservative movement. Nick Fuentes was not allowed to go to CPAC. Richard Spencer has been banned from CPAC. So like CPAC tries to maintain this idea that they're not full of white nationalists and that they are normal conservatives. Yeah. And so what we're watching is we're watching the right wing of the mainstream conservative movement tend towards Donald Trump. But we have to keep in mind that doesn't necessarily reflect the conservative movement as a whole, but it is an incredibly relevant thing to be paying attention to, especially because CPAC circles have a lot of money in them.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, and very ironic, and a lot of people have already pointed this out, is they've branded this year's CPAC conference as America Uncanceled. And the big news going into the conference was, in fact, that they had invited this person named Young Pharaoh, who is sort of this, it's an African-American person. They create content online, but they're like a Hotep, which is sort of like an alt-right, you know, version of black nationalism, I guess you could put it in some ways. But they had like created all this like anti-Semitic stuff, and they were people basically started sharing that, and they of course disinvited him from the conference. So they, in a sense, canceled this person. When their whole brand was, of course, you know, that like, you know, oh, we're the ones being canceled, and lo and behold, here they are doing the canceling. So that was, of course, hilarious. Yeah, Nick Fuentes did try to get in, as he does pretty much every year. Yeah, it was pretty pathetic. He showed up with, like, maybe 30 people, and they, like, called the security and the police, quote, gay and other homophobic slurs, which is just like pathetic to watch. And like they're all yelling at people for wearing masks, and half of them have masks on. It's just like it's just like all like consumable like fluff for like you know, the cameras and for social media. What was interesting though is that when you got into the actual like the event. And like, you know, in past years, they've really tried to like double down on like anti left wing conspiracy theories. Like they've had some like crazy stuff over the years. Like I remember a couple years ago, they had, somebody that was arguing that like, that there's like a secret history between Muslims and the Communist Party, and that which is sort of like removing Jews from the equation and putting in Muslims, you know, all the stuff that you'd kind of expect from somewhere like that. But a big thing, of course, this year was this idea that the left is canceling everything, and that under you know, democratic dictatorship, this is like what we have to live under, and it's just like communist China, everything's being canceled. And the examples they have is that the children of Dr. Seuss, who my understanding is that they're politically progressive, have decided not to reprint certain books that they consider to be racist, and Dr. Seuss has a history of promoting certain racist ideas for sure. But from my understanding, it's none of the stuff that most of us would associate with Dr. Seuss. It's not like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Cat in the Hat, all that stuff. It's kind of like lesser known things. But the Republicans seized on this, and they basically turned it into his family making the decision they're not going to republish certain books, turned it into the Democrats are, quote, canceling Dr. Seuss, which of course is just total misreading of the situation. The other example was that the Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head, who most of us have grown up with, they're going to just now call them Potato Heads, because the argument is that these are anthropomorphic potatoes that you put shit on, and that we don't need to assign a gender to them if we're going to then, you know, put different facial features and hats and coats around. So, in my mind, makes sense, but of course they're running with it. This is the end of freedom. This is the death of America, because, you know, we no longer have a Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head. This is an assault against the institution of marriage. If we can't live in a country where potatoes are married and we can put shit in their faces, you know, it's not a country worth living in anymore.
Yeah, I mean, right-wing politics and a lot of left-wing politics in the United States is incredibly reactionary. They're not often politics that are, you know, grounded in foundational principles and things like that, like anarchism or things like that. A lot of politics in the United States is driven by momentary outrage, right? And you see this with liberals, right? I mean, like any of us that know like liberal activist-y types, they're constantly upset about something, right? Which there's plenty to be upset about. But what's interesting is that what they're upset about constantly changes, right? Like any of us that have like kind of liberal parents who have found Facebook in the last 5 or 6 years, it's like talking to them at dinner about what they're upset about is a 2-hour long conversation that involves 25 different things, right? And it changes every week. And so there's something really powerful about that, that on some level, when you embrace political cynicism to that degree, where you no longer have to necessarily care or believe in what you say, that really it's all about just motivating engagement, right? It all just reduces itself down to, I mean, as you mentioned with Nick Fuentes, kind of like posing for cameras in order to put things online, right? Or in the case of the right wing, put things on Fox News. The goal there is engagement, right? So if we look at right wing politics in the United States, going back to about 1995 with Newt Gingrich being Speaker of the House, one of the things that you saw during that period was all of a sudden Republicans stopped talking about principles. And they only started talking about like weird real estate deals that the Clintons had been involved in, and like conspiracy theories and blah, 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 blah. The Seth Rich conspiracy theory is not the first conspiracy theory that's been put forward by the right wing about the Clintons killing someone. In the mid 90s, it was someone named Vince Foster, who committed suicide, who was not killed by the Clintons. But all of these things, like they don't have to be accurate or consistent or true. because when you're operating in a framework of constant outrage, nothing has a lifespan of more than a week or so, right? So we were talking about this before the show, but thinking back to like the first year of the Obama administration, the things that the right wing was upset about were things like Obama got Dijon mustard put on a hot dog, or the tan suit jacket debacle that happened, right? I mean, just like entirely meaningless stuff. This was before Obama was a, you know, secret Muslim, like fake citizen who was trying to take the country over for China, right? They developed that all later. But at the beginning, they didn't really have much to be upset about. So they just kind of came up with outrages, right? The Biden administration is way more boring than the Obama administration ever was. And so they have even less to be overtly outraged about. So what they're doing is they're falling back into culture war talking points, right? The entirety of CPAC was this. So if you actually paid attention to the speeches that happened there, there were a couple things that were really interesting about them. The first was, as I just mentioned, all of them were culture war based, right? Donald Trump Jr. talked about people getting canceled. There were multiple speeches about like Antifa storming the Capitol, you know, like all this stuff, right? Now, all of these are just like performative cultural talking points. They're not meant to be consistent. They don't have to be consistent. They don't have to have any persistence to them. They're just performative talking points. You articulate them as a way to sort of describe an affiliation to a certain kind of politics, right? It's the sort of aestheticization of all politics, right? The words that are being said don't really matter. So you saw this at the entirety of CPAC, and you're watching it kind of play out in right-wing media too. I mean, some of the things Tucker Carlson, for example, has been talking about are absurd. I mean, he's gotten to this point where he is now saying cancel culture is super awful because we went online and we looked for QAnon and we couldn't find them. So obviously all this outrage about QAnon is just left-wing cancel culture, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, if anyone just Googles the word QAnon, you're going to find like 8 million things. So what he's doing in a moment like that is he's essentially saying it does not matter whether every single person in the like moderate to left-wing political spectrum is going to make fun of us for saying we couldn't find QAnon, because that's not the point. The point is that Tucker Carlson said a thing that was critical of the quote left, and therefore if you identify as being a part of the quote right, you adopt that position. This has shifted from being a thing which only politicians used to do, right? And in the United States, we do not actually even have or had a strong culture of sort of party unity in the US. In Europe, for example, in parliamentary systems, party unity is everything. The whole party votes together, and when that stops happening, prime ministers get kicked out of office, right? In the US, politicians on a federal level specifically tended to have a lot more autonomy. But the Republican Party, as we've talked about on the show a number of times, has a very clear problem right now, which is that they are shrinking as an electoral bloc. Their voting population is shrinking. A lot of people in the Republican fold, in the conservative fold, that came in because of Trump, many of them have been convinced that all the elections are rigged and they're not going to participate anymore. And there's been tons and tons and tons of interviews in various media publications about this kind of dynamic, right? And so they're shrinking, they're falling apart, they're kind of collapsing and sort of realigning. And so what happens with the conservative movement in the US, what's happening currently is actually really fascinating. The first dynamic that's going on is this kind of revival of outrage politics, right? Like Trumpism is a politics of reactionary outrage, specifically white reactionary outrage. And they were able to kind of push those things for 4 years pretty unchallenged. Now that they're no longer in power, they're having a little bit of a harder time doing that. And so what they're doing is they're latching on to kind of culture war talking points that they can churn through 50 of them in a day on Fox News and keep all of their, you know, constituency angry about X, Y, or Z thing and therefore engaged, right? So that's a way to motivate activists, right? That's a way to motivate people to do voter registration campaigns and to motivate people to show up at town hall meetings and stuff like that. Like really what you're doing is you're trying to drive a sense of loyalty, right? If the other side is so awful then obviously you have to be loyal to us, right? And that's kind of the mentality that gets built up in outrage politics. But the problem that gets generated there is kind of twofold. And this is the other parts of what's typifying what's happening right now. The first is, at a certain point, those outrage-based narratives fall into absurdity. The Dijon mustard example is definitely one of them. The Mr. Potato Head example is another one. But, you know, we've seen a number of these kind of really ridiculous sort of things play themselves out over the years, including the right wing having to embrace conspiracy theories at points to try and continue the generation of the outrage machine, which then leads to these two problems. The first is that because the Republican Party is shrinking, because the conservative movement is shrinking, and because it's sort of in disarray at the moment, they can't afford to lose anybody. And what that means is that they are willing to embrace anybody that is willing to sort of side with them. And that involves embracing QAnon. That involves embracing Trumpism. And that involves embracing people like Nick Fuentes, who, I mean, we're about to talk about this in a little bit, but Republican politicians spoke at AFPAC and no other Republicans said anything about it. And that is actually a big shift from where we were 2 or 3 years ago. We'll get into examples of that in a little bit. But part of the reason that they can't disavow people like Nick Fuentes is, well, Nick Fuentes brings voters in, some at least, and makes a lot of noise on the internet. And so it'd be really damaging for them to ostracize a person like that. So they don't. They don't ostracize QAnon for the same reason, right? Individual Republican politicians are going out there to say stuff about it, but in reality, QAnon is a significant voting block for the Republican Party, and so they'll embrace it. And that leads to the second problem, which is that what we're seeing right now, what we saw at CPAC, is we saw a Republican Party kind of center wing lose control again. And we're kind of watching the same thing play out in Congress, too. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene can pretty much do whatever they want without consequences. Paul Gozer could speak at AFPAC without consequences. There's this sort of sense in which the center was starting to consolidate. And the center of the Republican Party was starting to consolidate control, and then they lost it again. And the way that they lost it was they lost it around very specifically the propelling of conspiracy theories about January 6th. That Republicans that were willing to accept that January 6th was carried out by Trump supporters on the encouragement of Trump directly have been censured by their state Republican parties, have been censured by caucuses in various state houses, so on, so on, so on, for doing nothing more than stating obviously observable pieces of information, right? What has happened in this moment, though, is that the kind of wing-nutty side of the Republican Party has gained so much inertia so quickly at this point because the entire conservative narrative was based around election conspiracy theories before this, that they've been able to consolidate enough that they are now driving the narrative again. This is the same thing that happened in 2010 with the Tea Party, where the Republican Party and people like the Koch brothers encouraged the Tea Party to come into existence. They funded it. They lent their organizers from their nonprofits to organize the thing. They purchased bus tickets for people. They, you know, funded, you know, fellowships. The Tea Party was an astroturfed political movement to a degree, but it also wasn't to a degree. And what happened in the process of them encouraging the Tea Party as a tactic to combat Obama was that they actually called that into the open, right? It's not like it wasn't there. It's not like there wasn't a kind of racist, small government, libertarian wing of the conservative movement at that time. It's just that it wasn't ascendant at that moment. By calling the Tea Party into existence, it became ascendant. And what we watched happen immediately after that was the Freedom Caucus got themselves elected in 2010 and immediately started making life difficult for House Republicans almost immediately, including getting John Boehner removed from the role of being Speaker of the House. So the Republican Party has this recent history of encouraging conspiracy theories and outrage as a way to drive engagement. Because if they don't drive engagement, they will lose all the time. And they've been sort of in this mode for the better part of 30 years. But periodically through that through that period, they lose control of the base, quote the base, right? And if you go back to people like William Crystal, the entirety of the Republican Party has always been grounded in this notion that there are elites that control the party, and they encourage other people to be active in the party, to vote for the interests of the people that run the party. And that all works as long as the base doesn't take control of that inertia. And what we've watched happen is that exact thing play itself out. The big question now becomes, how much can that fringe part of the Republican Party, that fringe part of the conservative movement, the people at CPAC, QAnon people, people that go to AFPAC, stuff like that, how much can they actually unite into a single block? I think that that's going to be the biggest question.
It just shows they're doubling down on these culture war talking points as like the main thing that they're branding themselves around, just how much the corporate parties really agree with each other in terms of like neoliberal economic policies, you know, a commitment to, you know, structural racism in the form of mass incarceration, the militarization of the border, network of detention facilities, just the militarization of the police in everyday life, the expanse of surveillance powers, and, you know, going after political dissidents. I mean, there's no real sort of break along those lines. There's pretty much consensus across the board. Yes. And what there is instead is this, you know, very bizarre kind of culture war that seems to animate a smaller and smaller amount of the population. I mean, really, like, I don't know about you, but, you know, when I walk outside and I talk to my neighbors, the first thing they say is not like, can you believe the Mr. Potato Head thing? Like, you know, it's just like, no, it's people are talking about real world issues. You know, yeah. The fact that the sky's on fire because there's fires everywhere and, you know, the seawater levels are rising, or I don't know, my pipes just burst and, you know, I don't have any water and my elected officials are flying to Cancun right now. I can't believe that the crew said that, you know. Talk about just what a fucking douchebag. I swear to God, just that he thought that, like, oh, we're kind of like with our friends now, I can really let my hair down and like really, really make a joke about going to Cancun. It's like, fuck you, dude. Seriously? Yep. And I mean, that just says a lot about how he views the people at CPAC as well. Like, they think that's just like the coolest shit in the world. Like, hell yeah, let those people die. You know?
Yes, and that's exactly the faction that is coalescing right now, right? Is that we're watching people who came from a variety of factions. I mean, Cruz was way more attached to the Tea Party years ago than the sort of authoritarian right wing, right? And we're watching a lot of people make that transition.
He was like one of the main people that was opposed to Trump coming in.
Yes, he was. Yeah, absolutely.
2016.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're watching a lot of people. I mean, Josh Hawley is doing this too, right? I mean, we're watching the beginning of people positioning themselves to make a run in 2024. And what happens in that process traditionally is we do watch these realignments occur. So I think the thing that we really need to be paying attention to coming out of a thing like CPAC is not the straw polls. I mean, like, yes, Trump only getting 55% support for even running again is a really important indicator. So, like, we do need to pay attention to that. But it's not even necessarily the content of the speeches. It's, like, general themes that we need to pay attention to. Because the general themes of CPAC are going to tell us a lot about what we're about to see. And we're watching that already play out on Fox, right? I mean, Fox News has pretty much reverted entirely to Obama-era culture war stuff over the last couple of weeks, almost entirely. And there's a logic to that. It's not just outrage, but in engaging in culture war narratives, it's really easy to demonize the quote other side, right? So anyone that disagrees with you all of a sudden is not just someone who disagrees with you, but is now a heathen who's trying to destroy your good Christian way of life, right? And that in order to preserve your way of life or reestablish a certain way of life, you have to destroy those people. Because if you don't destroy them, they're just going to cancel you or get in the way. We wonder why there was such a heavy narrative of civil war on the right wing, right? And our answer is right there. They've been doing culture war ever since Reagan. And well, ever since the 1960s, they've been engaged in culture war narratives. And there's even ways to make arguments that even existed before that, right? Like you could go back to John Birch Society and anti-communism in the 1950s and see indications of that as well. And so this is not new. with the right, the kind of culture war narrative. But the ways that that culture war narrative is going to play out now in 2021 are going to be really important to pay attention to. For example, how much do issues of race rise to the top of that narrative? Because if issues of race start rising to the top of that narrative, as opposed to Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss, well, all of a sudden, we're going to watch a very different reality play itself out on the right wing, one that's going to be even more overtly racist than what we've already seen. If they stay away from questions of race, if they just stick straight to like Christian culture war stuff like they had been, it's likely that we're going to see an ascendancy of the religious right. Right. So these are the kind of dynamics that we need to be paying attention to coming out of CPAC.
Yeah, for sure. And also, you know, to point out, too, is that there is also not this sort of thing that Trump did where he tried to kind of like outflank the left and like appeal to this sort of like economic nationalism or, you know, populism. I mean, that all seems to be done now. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. they call themselves populists, but when I hear the quote unquote America First people, I mean, they're not talking about shutting down U.S. bases around the world and like bringing the troops home or whatever. They're talking about, you know, QAnon, or they're talking about Mr. Potato Head. Like that is like, you know, the populist framework, you know,
yeah.
there's no grand policy, you know, like Trump basically ran on all that and lied completely. I mean, remember he was saying he was going to like, you know, find an alternative to Obamacare and it was going to be better and everyone was going to be covered. You know, he was talking about bringing all these jobs back overseas. I mean, none of that happened, you know, mm-hmm. You know, and like, you know, we critiqued that, you know, from a left-wing anti-capitalist position and talked about really how that was, you know, really a smoke and mirrors thing to get production to move back to the U.S., but then it would be a race to the bottom because you know, there'd be automation and there'd be all these factors. And of course, like Trump and his people are, of course, you know, not pro-union or not pro-class struggle, which is how people got good jobs back in the 1950s to begin with. There was a massive strike wave when people returned from World War II, so on and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of nuts and bolts to this thing, but I mean, clearly, whatever sort of populist swill that Trump was spending to people, I mean, that doesn't even really seem to be in the mix anymore, because it seems like I think that they've realized that those people are not voting for him anymore, and that the people that are the sort of boomers that are animated by QAnon Facebook groups and stuff.
Yeah, well, there's that, and a really basic problem that politicians run into that I think the conservative movement thinks that they can just dodge around, which is when politicians make promises, people hold them accountable for carrying those promises through. So if you never make any, then there's nothing to hold you accountable for, right? And one of the dynamics that's really building up here is this notion, and Trump was a, you know, just clear physical manifestation of this, but the idea that one never needs to even speak about accountability, that the moment that you take an action is already exalted and outside of discussions of right or wrong, that if you are to criticize an action, then obviously you're doing that because you're some like raging leftist, right? Not because the person who took the action just kind of acted like an asshole. And so what happens in that kind of dynamic is a number of things. I mean, one of the things that happens is an echo chamber builds up, right? What you're doing is you're building permanent loyalty by demonizing everybody else. And in the process of demonizing everybody else, you end up constructing a reality in which all points of information just refer back to each other. And it becomes harder and harder and harder for, quote, newer people to sort of become a part of that, right? The discourse sort of moves way faster than people are able to keep up if they're not already very much a part of it. And so within those echo chambers, you start to have things like populism now all of a sudden not having anything to do with policy proposals or any proposals. Now populism is purely about sort of negative rejection politics of outrage, right? Which is a really strange, completely new appropriation of the concept of populism, right? And that's really coming out of this sort of mentality. So the problem that they're going to have, though, is at this point in 2021, I think it's fair to argue that most Americans could care less about policy positions at this moment in time. That this last election had almost nothing to do with policy. I don't think most people could even tell you what Joe Biden's policy positions were in detail. Superficially, sure, but in detail, no. And Trump just never had any. And so we've really watched an election play out just now, which was entirely about declarations of loyalty or declarations of lack of loyalty, right? This is the direction that specifically right-wing politics is going in right now. The left is having other issues with sort of embracing kind of absurdities, and we'll talk about this in a second, but the right wing is falling into this trap of echo chambers we've been talking about for a long time. But as Trump is out of power, as he is no longer in the news, as they're not able to craft narratives around pieces of information as effectively as they were before, the echo chamber is going to start to coalesce around other things. And right now, that is sort of Christian social, like Christian culture war issues at this point.
Two things I want to point out for people, just to kind of bring it back down to real world action, is that, you know, we right now have no idea when, you know, schools and stuff are going to be reopening across the United States and everybody's going to have a vaccine. That could be a whole other show in itself, but it does seem like that reality is getting closer, and that it does seem like, you know, the Groypers are going to be sort of the fascist kind of force that's going to exist in the near, in, you know, the coming terrain, that's going to like survive, more or less the purge after the Capitol, attempted coup. So I think it would make sense for anti-fascists now to begin to map those networks, find out who those people are, because when the schools do open back up, you can rest assured that in every Turning Point USA group, every College Republican group, there's going to be Groyper people.
Oh yeah.
And they're going to be vying for power and trying to influence those organizations, just like American Identity Movement, who some of those people probably used to be involved with, did a couple years ago. So it would make sense to get a head start now. And, you know, when the schools do open back up, you can rest assured that those are the people they're going to be asking for, you know, Paul Gosar to come speak at their campus, you know, in a, maybe a year from now, or whatever kind of events that they're doing or sort of actions or things that they're organizing on their campus. So let's get a head start now. Let's find out who those people are, map those networks, find out their connections to the established political order, and expose them. Because we all know that, you know, they have two sides to them. There's one side online and there's another that they're putting out to the rest of the world. I mean, case in point, Bellingcat just released this photo and video of this young Groyper leader. There's literally a photo of her with Nick Fuentes at a rally in D.C., I think, in late December. And it turns out she was one of the people that stole Nancy Pelosi's laptop. And there's photos of her with a siege mask doing a Nazi salute and sharing all these kind of like siege memes and stuff like that. So she's like full on neo-Nazi hanging out with Nick Fuentes. I mean,
well, and what's disturbing about it is, you know, Nick Fuentes is really good at media, in ways that Charlie Kirk wasn't, right? And what's happening with America First and kind of groups like that is they're starting to replace organizations like Turning Point USA, where TPUSA was still very tied in with kind of traditional Republican funding structures. And the goal of people in TPUSA and the leadership was to be relevant Republican operatives that kind of push a right-wing populist politics, right? But did so within the realm of the Republican Party. What we're watching with people like Nick Fuentes right now is we're watching him use the fact that he's relatively media savvy and the fact that the network that he's built is not huge, but it's not small. And they make a lot of noise. And he's used that and parlayed that into actually having connections to the mainstream Republican Party, right? So Paul Gosar spoke at AFPAC, right? Paul Gosar is a Republican House representative from Arizona. He has traditionally had tons of connections with militia groups in Arizona, which, for those of you that don't know, militia groups in Arizona tend to be spectacularly, like shockingly, even by American standards, racist. It's pretty normal for members of militia groups in Arizona to also be members of like National Socialist Movement and groups like that, very overtly. Not in the quiet way that that happens in other parts of the country, but very, very, very overtly. And so he goes to speak at this conference, and there's a number of things that are shocking about this very specific instance. The first is he was there at all. What that says is that Nick Fuentes has sort of become a person who has influence in certain Republican circles, which is really disturbing because he's a Holocaust denying Nazi. But yet he has access to these people, right? He has the ability to get Paul Gosar to give a speech at his conference, or Steve King for that matter, right? But the second shocking thing about this is after Paul Gosar gave that speech, no one in the Republican Party said anything against him doing that. Nobody. There were a few Republicans that said, yeah, I mean, like, if there were Nazis there, that's bad. But there wasn't like a statement from the Republican Party. There wasn't a statement from the House Republican Caucus, nothing. To compare that to when Steve King, a number of years ago, not that many years ago, tweeted something along the lines of, I don't understand what's so offensive about the term white supremacy, tweeted that and got yanked from all of his committee positions. And this is a guy that had been in Congress for well over 10 years at that point, got yanked from all of his committee positions for a tweet. Paul Gosar goes and gives an entire speech at AFPAC and nothing happens. And that's the difference of 3 or 4 years of time. Now, if we then start to think about what AFPAC represents, this starts to get a little bit more disturbing. So TPUSA was definitely a gateway to the alt-right. I don't think there's anyone that can deny that. Many TPUSA people moved on to become figures in the alt-right afterwards. There were some figures in the alt-right that were members of TPUSA directly. That was all really well documented, right? But a lot of those people were sort of noobs to politics, right? Like a lot of TPUSA people were not necessarily particularly experienced. They weren't particularly like Nazis, right? Like they weren't members of Nazi organizations. They didn't read Siege. You know, some of them went on to do that later. But usually when they were members of TPUSA, they were racist and they were making racist jokes, but they weren't wearing skull masks and reading copies of Siege. That at that point was confined to accelerationist groups like the Atom Waffen Division, right, or the base. What we're watching now, though, with America First is actually this really disturbing. It's not even an entry point anymore. It's like a doorway that's been flung open, right, where people who became involved with America First at the beginning, people like Michelle Malkin, are well-known Republican Party operatives. Right. They're often sort of like opinion columnists. They have a lot of readership. They have a lot of pull in ways that these college kids that were part of TPUSA did not have. Nick Fuentes is able to get people like Paul Gosar to speak at a conference. But at the same time, he's taking pictures of people in skull masks who also have taken pictures of themselves holding copies of Siege. Right. What AFPAC represents and what America First represents is actually something very different from TPUSA. And actually a lot more like the American Identity Movement, but probably much more militant in the sense that what they're doing is they're essentially creating a mainline for militant right-wing racists, right? Neo-Nazis, white nationalists that have been involved in white nationalist groups to enter into Republican Party circles, not in an attempt to influence the Republican Party. And I think that this is really important. TPUSA was an attempt to influence the Republican Party. America First is not. If you listen to Nick Fuentes and when he gives speeches, it's always about destroying the Republican Party. And that doesn't mean that there will be no Republican Party, right? That's not what he's saying, that he doesn't want there to be a conservative party. It's that he wants to replace the conservative party. He wants America First to become the conservative party, right? And in that process, bring along much of what currently occupies the right wing of the conservative movement, but with official positions. And so, as opposed to TPUSA, which was trying to really like build up a cadre of people to sort of work their way up in Republican circles over time, what's happening with America First is that they're trying to use a lot of the same techniques that TPUSA use. They're trying to use memes. They're trying to use, you know, media-centric strategies. They're trying to use, you know, call centers and all this other stuff to do this kind of work. They're going to be primarily organizing on campuses and things like that. The aesthetic that they put forward is very similar to TPUSA, but the politics and the goals are radically different, in the sense that, again, they're trying to replace the Republican Party immediately, not influence it. And they're actually getting support in that process.
Their whole battle cry after the Capitol was that they're going to destroy the Republican Party.
Yep.
Yep. And then, you know, their whole big coming out party was when they went and trolled Charlie Kirk. So, I mean, they're trying to push those people out because they're not openly white nationalist enough.
Yep. And they're trying to move in and occupy that exact same space that's evacuated when a group like TPUSA disappears. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, as you said, I mean, they've already found some inroads into the existing Republican Party, and they're going to continue to find those because they're not opposed to bringing, people into that structure and getting people to vote for people like Trump. I mean, that's part of the trade-off, and that's why they're continuing to get support. If they were more of sort of a, you know, insurgent sort of force that was like against electoralism or against you know, the Republican Party just as it is, that I'm sure they wouldn't be getting the same
kind of rollout. I mean, we have to think of Nick Fuentes in the same way that we would think of someone like David Duke, right? So like David Duke ran as a Republican. But David Duke was a Klansman, and that's the politics he put forward, right? And the goal, his goal, was not to be a prominent Republican. His goal was to use power to reinstitute state-sponsored white nationalism. Whether or not that was as a Republican or as a Democrat or as an independent didn't matter to him. He didn't care. That's a lot more like what's happening here. The difference is that when David Duke was doing it in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, people in the conservative movement, roundly, including Donald Trump, roundly rejected him for being a racist, right? And never let him really gain a foothold in conservative circles, even though he was winning elections in Louisiana. The difference is that, well, Nick Fuentes has that influence that David Duke never had. He obviously has funding sources that David Duke never had, right? Just the simple reality of the fact that he got a $250,000 Bitcoin transfer in the days leading up to January 6th is pretty telling. That money didn't come from nowhere, and that's not an insignificant chunk of change. And so the fact that someone just like tossed that money at him before a protest tells me that the pockets that he's sort of in contact with are a lot deeper than they might look. And that in itself is also very disturbing. And so, you know, we did not, as anti-fascists, I think, really do a good job of mapping out what was going on in TPUSA. I mean, we mapped out locally what was happening on certain campuses and certain cities and stuff like that. But as far as really understanding the funding structures, really understanding the levers of political power that exist behind the scenes, we didn't really get a good view into that. What has kind of become a little interesting about America First is that it has become a victim of the political churn just like everybody else on the right wing has. And people have recently left the organization while new people have joined. And so in a process in which that churn happens, certain pieces of information tend to become public and tend to be able to be found. And so what we need to be doing at this point is we need to be tracing that network, right? Like, they're not like tattooed skinheads like Brian James. You know, they're not American Guard. They're not people like that. And in a lot of ways, they're a lot more dangerous than the American Guard is, right? The American Guard will shoot people eventually, right? That's absolutely going to be a thing that happens. And that will be tragic and horrible. What the American Guard will never do is seize power as the American Guard. Nick Fuentes is definitely positioning himself, not necessarily to seize power in any sort of real meaningful way, but to get power in a real meaningful way. And he's actually been really effective at that. And we need to really trace out how an early 20-something, like, arrogant kid ends up with a congressperson speaking at his conference and where he's getting all the money for this. Like, those are really relevant questions that we need to be answering right now.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.